Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Friday, September 9th, 2011. I'm your host, Greg Luca, and I am joined by two writers who are definitely ready to make some big improvements after learning a lot about themselves in week one. We have Tyler Jett.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm a guy who podcasting is very important to me.
And we have from FightingGators.com, we have Cody Jones.
Yeah, we watched the film from last week. A lot of room for improvement, but I like where this thing's going.
All right, on today's show, we're going to talk a little bit about, we're going to give you a little bit of a UAB preview, and before we get into that, we're going to talk some of the news this week about Sharif Floyd and his suspension, and we're going to talk a little bit about Texas A&M potentially joining the SEC in the near future. Before we get into that, we're going to address an email we have this week. Be sure, if you guys want to join in this email party, send any feedback to podcast@alligator.org. So just anything you want to tell us there, we can get to that. But we have an email from Ed Spillane this week, and he wants to know why Demps and Rainey decided to change their jersey numbers as they did. And I think we have Tyler to answer this one. He's the expert on jersey numbers and all things Chris Rainey.
I am the Chris Rainey and jersey number beat writer, so I'm actually the guy to go to on this. Jeff Demps said on media day that he changed his number to 28 because he wanted to be like a real running back, which is like, you know, great for any University of Florida player to say in light of Urban Meyer's departure, is to say that they are now playing a real position, because, you know, that was never a tough talking point with Urban Meyer in the past.
The Tim Tebow real quarterback thing, no big deal.
And as far as Chris Rainey going to number one, do we really need to explain why Chris Rainey went to number one? Like, if you know anything about Chris Rainey, you know why he's jersey number one. It's because every woman in the stadium will be wearing a jersey that's called number one, and that's a great way to start conversations or to start stalking a girl.
Oh, that's fair. I didn't even think about how they just sell the generic number
one. Yeah, they always sell the number one jersey. That's why, like, everyone wants to be number one. That's why Janoris was. That's why Percy was number one. That's why Chris Rainey is number one.
Chris Rainey, now joining that elite group. It's a good move for Chris Rainey.
It's a really intelligent group, too.
I like it.
It's probably the three dumbest people on the team in the past.
Wow. Not afraid to go there.
Well, would you disagree?
I
don't know about Percy, actually.
I'd sell those three short. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think Percy would be the smartest of the
team. Yeah, Percy would be smart. But the other two, not the brightest guys on the team.
I don't know. Chris Rainey, at least he talks. Like, he could be dumber.
I don't know if he could. Can we? Is there any way we can get some audio from the Chris Rainey podcast or interviews? Like, can we get that on a podcast in the future?
I will try my best, because that would be outstanding.
That would be beautiful.
It's always great audio.
It'd be super good.
I mean, I have to cut out all the long delays while I think about it.
No, keep those in there. That's great. There's a lot of,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to get started with some of the off-the-field news this week. A lot of that stuff going around. Biggest thing is Sharif Floyd. We found out yesterday that he's going to be suspended for one more game. He's going to have to arrange to repay. He doesn't actually have to repay it before the Tennessee game. But he has to arrange to repay $2,700 in assistance money that he received for unofficial visits when he was in the part of the recruiting process. A lot of this was part of the Student Athlete Mentoring Foundation, which he was a big part of. Sharif Floyd, for those of you who haven't heard anything about it, apparently grew up with a very rough background, didn't have a lot of the things that a lot of people take for granted, and as a result, had to go to other sources whenever possible to have the money to make his visits and make an informed college decision. And the NCAA has decided that any kind of assistance like that from outside sources is against NCAA rules. And as such, they've decided to suspend him for another game here. So I guess it's a two-game suspension total, counting last week. Muschamp had a strong reaction to this. He was shocked and disappointed, as he put it.
He was disgusted.
Yeah, there you go. So just what's your guys' reaction to this when you first heard the news?
I guess that's much less of a problem than what we all suspected because of the places he did go on official visits to, North Carolina, Ohio State, USC. And when you're around those schools and there's this much smoke going on, I assumed that there was something going on with those schools. And so to find out that it was this situation, the SAM, as they call it, I honestly didn't think it was a huge deal. What'd you think, Cody?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think especially, I kind of understand where Will Muschamp's coming from. I definitely respect the way he went about it. I think that's kind of a good rallying point for your players from a coaching standpoint. But it's kind of an interesting thing, too, because, you know, like, where does the NCAA, like, where do they draw the line at, you know? Like, if a player, just because he is poor, like, clearly he needed some sort of assistance to go on visits and make a decision like that. But I think, like, where do you draw that line, you know, as the NCAA? That's what I've been trying to figure out, too. Like, you can't just let a bunch of players take a bunch of assistants just who may have the money. I think, I don't know, it's an interesting dynamic to it.
Right, I'm sure this goes on a lot, because Sharif Floyd's not the only poor kid who goes to play college football. And like they said, you go to these junior days, your junior year of high school, and all these different things. that schools aren't paying for. Like, colleges can't pay for your trips unless it's an official visit, and you only get, like, five of those, and you know these guys are going to more than five colleges to check out what's offered. You know this kind of stuff's going on. There's a place called the student-athlete mentoring situation. Like, you know that they're doing this more than just this one time. So, like, it's kind of interesting. How do they – I guess Sharif apparently told the coaches about this, who then reported it in February. But it's shocking to me that it would take this long to get sorted out. Some things just don't seem to fit there to me. Like, it doesn't make sense, first of all, that Sharif would say anything about this, and second of all, that it happened in February, and here we are in September, and it's finally getting resolved.
And the fact that it came out apparently within 24 hours, we found out minutes before kickoff, too, I think is really, really strange.
Yeah, the fact that they're going to, like, he came forward and admitted that he received, like, need-based aid. This isn't like some of the stuff we heard about with Miami, where it's all just, like, superfluous extra benefits, fun stuff like that.
Yeah, hookers don't normally fall under the need-based aid category.
Like, he needed this to make an informed college decision, which is something that a lot of stuff with the recruiting process lately, it's just trying to get the athletes the best information so they can make the best decision for their life and their career. And that's just all he's trying to do in this, and now he's being punished for it. I don't think that's necessarily justified.
For a game more than some of the Miami players were, too. I thought that's what was really interesting to me, that kind of stood out, was the fact that they knowingly took extra benefits like that to go have fun in South Beach, whereas he's trying to figure out what college he wants to go to and get suspended for more games than some of those Miami guys.
Yeah, I guess it's a little bit weird. I guess at the end of the day, though, I mean, it's not going to matter that much. It's FAU and UAB, the alphabet soup of Florida's schedule.
Right.
Like, it's not going to be a huge deal. One thing I wanted to bring up is what were your thoughts on Muschamp doing this via statement, like releasing a statement as opposed to doing this, like, on, like, live, either in a press conference or, like, release a video, like, on Gator Vision or whatever, the official website, or on YouTube or something like that? Because I feel like the big thing with Muschamp, the thing that everyone rallies behind, is how passionate he is. Since he's gotten here, you watch the videos from him on the sidelines. Like, that's been the thing that everyone's loved about this guy. When he got riled up in the third quarter of the FAU game, the crowd went nuts. Like, that's his thing. And that's not, like, this worst thing to be known for. No matter what he does in his career, he's always going to be known as, like, Coach Boom. Like, that's going to happen. And I feel like you might as well just play that up in, like, you're clearly passionate. He's saying words like, I'm disgusted in the NCAA. He's sticking it to the man, which I'm all for. I think that's great. But why do it in a statement? Like, that's something with that much passion, you should just do it in a video, in my opinion.
Well, the way our media schedule works out, I mean, obviously you guys know this, but for people listening, we wouldn't normally talk to Muschamp until Saturday. So he didn't have an opportunity before the game to really do it. I could see where you would want to put a video out there, but I think that's kind of the thing where the PR people in the UAA are like, well, let's not have him yelling into the camera, and let's maybe get this, and we have a little more control on our end about the message that gets out. So
Muschamp had plenty. If you release a video, you have plenty of control how it goes. It's not going to be a live video.
Well, I mean, like, from the perspective of, like, there was a joke on Twitter that somebody made about how, like, I'm sure there was a lot of expletives deleted from the Muschamp statements when they released it. Like, I think if he was really, if he is this passionate guy, is something that is obviously true. Everybody knows that that's what he's known for, like you said. It's just something that you probably don't want to put out there what he's actually thinking. You get the gist of it, you get the passion, you get that, but it's a more controlled
I disagree. I think he needs to embrace it.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, too, is we wouldn't have talked to him until Saturday, so it would have lost its luster a little bit if he did it then.
Well, you could have, yeah, I mean, but you could have figured something out. Like, it's not like you sit there and it's like, well, our hands are tied here. I'm the coach of the University of Florida, but I have no options until being silent until Saturday. Like, he could have done other things other than release a statement. Like, I feel like there would have been way cooler ways. Like, that was pretty cool, but I feel like if his thing is going to be the guy who's just going to be the wild man sometimes, that he can figure out better ways to do it than just releasing a statement. Like, I think there's way cooler ways to do it.
It still kind of served its purpose, though, you know?
Like, yeah, no, it did. That's true. I'm not arguing that it didn't serve its purpose, but I guess my point is that I would have liked to actually see, like, if you're going to be that emotional, I would like to see it.
And it definitely sets the record for most passionate statement I've ever seen released. Like, you know, it's normally pretty, we support our student athletes in everything they do in life. But this was a little more intense than that.
There's some color in it, for sure.
You could kind of tell with Jeremy Foley's statement, too, that he was pretty unhappy about it and definitely stood behind Floyd quite a bit. But, yeah, I don't think anybody saw that much of a passionate one from Muschamp coming. Yeah.
As far as the punishment went, it ended up being two games. It said they also considered four. The NCAA also considered levying a four-game suspension against him, but decided that because there's kind of the mitigating circumstances of his rough upbringing, they decided to settle on two. Do you guys think that's a fair number? I mean, how would you have handled this situation in the NCAA's shoes?
I don't know. I'm not for, like, changing, like, fluctuating it based on someone's situation, because you're just sort of opening a gate where it's like, we're real fluid in this. And I kind of, from the NCAA's perspective, I kind of like the idea of, like, money is money. Like if it's $2,000, it's four games. If it's $1,000, it's two games. And you have that set in stone or whatever it is. And instead of this where you're fluctuating it from time to time, from circumstance to circumstance, because then it's just sort of like you're opening yourself up to be kind of hypocritical and like other people who may, let's say I get $2,000 to play football, but I get four games, but Sharif Floyd gets two games. And it's sort of like, I don't know. I just think that's kind of unfair.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. I think it seems about right, the two-game suspension, if that's the route that they want to go. Because, again, it does kind of open up some things to where you've got a bunch of players who maybe don't have the financial background that he has growing up, and then they start accepting benefits. Like, you have to draw a line somewhere. I understand that might come across a little weird, but at some point, I think, I don't know. Do you understand where I'm coming from with that at all?
Well, I guess you're kind of making the argument that it needs to be more fluid, and I'm making the argument that it shouldn't be more fluid.
True.
I guess that's what it is. I mean, I'm just saying, like, I think, like, personally, if I was just, like, a guy who was kind of shooting from the hip, I'd be like, yeah, Sharif Floyd, two games is fine. But from a situation where you're kind of making what is essentially a law
within
your organization, it should be, like, not fluid. It should be solid. It should be $2,000 is four games every time or something along those lines.
Well, I don't know. I think I'm more with Cody on this because I do think there's a huge difference between the $2,000 Sharif Floyd needed to make these trips and the $2,000 another guy gets just to buy a new car or something like that.
Well, yeah, from a personal standpoint, yeah, that'd be great, but you can't like roll in that way. Like you can't just shoot from the hip when you're making any sort of law. Like it's a rule is a rule from the rulemaker's perspective, you can't just be like, all right, we're just gonna let people slide now and then later we're gonna enforce it on these people and just adjust it from person to person because we know what this person's intentions were, we know what this person's intentions were. You don't always it's hard to like rule from like where someone's coming from emotionally or something like that. You've got to kind of let that out and just look at the facts. Yeah. Even though like it's like obviously like, he's not spending this money to be irresponsible, it's still like you kind of just look at the bottom line.
Yeah, there's no like straightforward way to police that. It probably is better just in theory as opposed to you actually get in there and it just kind of it clouds things up a little bit.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I feel like it makes sense that you would want to have the same punishment so that there doesn't have to be a fight or a debate like this every time. But I just feel like it's tough when you have these kind of circumstances to punish people equally.
Well, it's tough, but I know, but it's just the way it has to be at the end of the day.
No, that makes sense.
And yeah, I just used the word at the end of the day, so that's how important this is
to you.
To me.
All right, so...
to nobody else, apparently.
I think that's enough on Sharif Floyd. Moving into the other big off-the-field story for this week, we have that Texas A&M has officially decided that it's willing to make the move to the SEC. SEC will have Texas A&M, but the one thing holding this all up is that the other Big 12 schools have not all waived their right to sue for damages related to Texas A&M leaving the conference. Do I have that right?
It's a very wordy way to say it. They're basically like, hey, we're going to sue you if you leave because we're going to lose money if you leave. Essentially, is what it is. Now, the SEC the whole time has operated it like we don't want to be a home wrecker. We don't want to come in and take your wife or take your husband or whatever you want to call Texas A&M. And Dan Beebe obviously sent a letter to Mike Slatt saying, hey, it's cool. Y'all can take Texas A&M. They want out. Whatever. Just do it. Probably in more formal words than that. And then the SEC presidents got together and said, all right, let's vote on this. They all decided, of course, we're going to take Texas A&M. We're getting that Texas market. We're going to expand. Here we go. Let's do this. And then, of course, they find out that one school is protesting it. And then all of a sudden it's seven schools that are protesting it. And obviously I think everyone knows it's led by Baylor, who's got the most to lose from the Big 12 collapsing.
I kind of understand where they're coming from, too. You know,
Baylor?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure, from their perspective.
Yeah, I mean, think about, like, you're losing a ton of money like that. Yeah, you wouldn't let that just walk away without at least a fight.
Yeah, for sure. Baylor's the team, Tyler and I were talking about this a little while ago, that they're the team that could most likely have to find themselves in a much smaller conference and isn't going to get invited to a place like the SEC, and they're not going to end up in the pack, whatever number you want to end that with. And they're going to have to find a lower-level place to kind of settle in. Because they aren't the same market as a lot of the Texas A&M and the Texas and the Oklahoma obviously are.
Yeah, the premier conferences aren't, you know, fighting to get into the Waco, Texas market. I don't know if you've ever been to Waco, Texas, but it's a terrible town. My mom actually went to college in Baylor, and the campus is terrible. The city is terrible. Like, no one really wants, seriously, like, there's no reason that if any big conference team, like, all right, we got to get that Waco television market. Nobody cares. Baylor's got the most to lose in this situation. I don't blame them for fighting this. But I kind of think all this is doing is delaying the inevitable. Texas A&M, if this is what's going on, Texas A&M just goes independent for a year and then joins the SEC next year is essentially what's going to happen. Like, it's not like you're going to completely handcuff Texas A&M forever. Also, I mean, you got to figure that these other schools are going to the Pac-12. Like, this is this is going to happen. The Big 12 is going to fall apart.
That is what it seems like. They're just kind of trying to stall things out a little bit, maybe get their extra revenue from it for as long as they can, knowing full well that it's not going to be there for too long.
Is that how you see this playing out? Do you think there's going to have to be an independent year in between, or do you think they're going to get this done relatively soon and we'll be able to start a Texas A&M and SEC play next season?
Unfortunately, I think it's going to take a year of independent first. I just don't see, because if these Big 12 schools are resisting now, what's going to make them stop?
Right. You know what I mean? I mean, that's a fair point, but at some point, like, would they have a shot to win if they decided to sue on account of this? Or is that, like, something that's a realistic opportunity, or are they just kind of stating their claim that they're not happy about the move?
I have no idea.
I think contractually they would have a chance to win.
Because I feel like you know,
this, I think because
like,
contractually, happens, right? Well, I mean, Texas
just automatically they all decide to waive it and everybody moves on with their life.
I feel like it's happened once in the past, but I can't remember when it's happened. I feel like some schools have tried to resist.
Anyway, my only point is that if resistance isn't likely to get them anywhere, I think it's more likely that they could just decide, all right, I guess they're not going to give in on this, and then they just let them go, and then we can start this sooner than rather than later. But
I mean, I guess I think Texas A&M will ultimately have to go independent.
Okay, so now we're going to move into a little bit of a UAB preview for this weekend. The Gators take on the UAB Blazers on Saturday at 7 in the Swamp. It's going to be a real exciting game for sure, as are always the opening two before Tennessee. Tyler, what are you looking forward to see out of Florida this weekend? One area you'll be watching?
Definitely the defensive backs. I think that's the big thing with this UAB team. The scouting report is that this team can actually throw the ball, whereas FAU couldn't throw the ball. FAU Graham Wilbert came in with like 2 career passing attempts or whatever. Now UAB's quarterback Brian Ellis actually had a pretty good year last year. He came off the bench to start in the Troy game, or actually appeared halfway through the Troy game and led this big comeback in like the third game of the year, and then started from that point on in 9 starts. He had like 2,900 passing yards, 25 touchdowns, almost led them on an upset of Tennessee at Neyland Stadium last year. That game ended up getting decided in the second overtime. Point is, like, they have an established passing game. They have a good system. Their last 2 years have been like their most productive years in school history offensively. More than 5,000 total yards both times. So you're going to get the ball down the field some, and you're actually going to see this young defensive backfield. We didn't see much of it in the FAU game.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt. That's the position with the most interest around it. I think another one, kind of because of that, is the pass rush, and get to see a little bit more of the blitz scheme that seemed like was extremely vanilla last week. I can't remember any maybe different blitzes or anything that they showed at all. I think they actually rushed 3 or 4 pretty much every time, and that's really all they needed to do. So, yeah, I think that'll be interesting to watch those guys right there and against a more traditional offense, a more traditional drop-back quarterback, and see if they can get to
him. Right. The secondary is something for sure that I'm going to be looking at. I think after last week, a lot of people were kind of trying to make judgments on the secondary, but I just felt like there was nothing you could take away from that because of the fact that there was so much pressure on FAU's quarterback, and FAU's quarterback wasn't good. Like, there was nothing that the secondary really had to prove in that game. I thought they had an extremely easy job. And I think this weekend, if Florida's going to do well, it's going to depend on them a lot, which was not the case so far.
Right. I think Muschamp's kind of talked about how they're going to use a nickel package a lot more this week than they did last week. I guess Pop Saunders will roll over and play some nickel. They'll put Josh Evans at free safety, which they did a little bit of against FAU, but you'll see a heavier dose of that defensive backfield.
Do you think that's a better look for them to get Saunders in the nickel spot and then put like Evans at safety, or do you think it's better with maybe Saunders at safety and another one of those guys at the corner position? What do you think is probably best, given what you know about the personnel for Florida?
I think he said Riggs would be the other nickel along with Saunders. So if you slide him in there, maybe put like Roberson and a Jalen Watkins out at corner as well. I kind of like that a little bit more, thinking about it, because I know Evans is a guy that physically I think should be really productive for this team, but for whatever reason wasn't really last year when he subbed in for Will Hill a little bit. I think that would probably be the route that I would go, but again, they probably know better than I do.
Right. Based on what we saw last year, I totally agree with you in that. Yeah. No Josh Evans, but again, we don't really know exactly, because we didn't see practice, obviously, and FAU was worse than our practice, I assume, for the defensive backs. Like, they did not get a good workout there. We didn't really get to see them tested. There was like one big completion that was on Matt Elam, but that was more or less like a guy that slipped past the zone, whatever. We'll actually get to see this week and we'll have a better judgment. But based on last season, I think you're correct. I would rather have Pop Saunders at safety, put Cody Riggs at nickel, and then obviously have Roberson, Jalen Watkins, Moses Jenkins, maybe.
Yeah. The fact that we don't know is kind of the point, I feel like, because like we said, we haven't seen them. They were untested last week, and now this is the kind of question that maybe going forward from this week we'll have some of the answers to. But right now, I think we're just very unsure where that's headed. Another thing Cody touched on briefly was the pass rush. Last week, I feel like it was all up the middle. One thing they talked about was that the edge rush wasn't as great as they needed it to be. What do you guys think they have to do to kind of improve that area? Where do you see that going from here?
To improve that area, they need to get Sharif Floyd back and get William Green on the bench. But for now, obviously, I think their pass rush was okay last week. Like, they only had two sacks, but I think Dan Quinn kind of touched on Wednesday. They had a lot of pressures. Like, you just watched that game. I don't have the numbers on me of how many times they pressured the quarterback, how many times they tipped passes, anything like how many times they hit the quarterback or anything like that. But just watching the game, you saw that Graham Wilbert or the other quarterback, Cooey, was never really comfortable out there. So I think the pass rush did okay overall. I think right now it's just a personnel issue for the defensive ends.
And it's still kind of an edge rush thing, too, that they didn't have. Again, I agree with you. I think a majority of that is because of William Green, and that'll get back when Floyd is back next weekend. But, again, I think that still is an issue for them. I thought, you know, Ronald Powell did some things. I don't think he was maybe as disruptive as people expected. But, again, a lot of that comes down to the type of offense that FAU was running. It's going to be a run-based offense and really quick throws and everything like that. So it kind of eliminates that pass rush. So, again, we're kind of going in this weekend with the thought of, you know, we'll kind of see what we know about that as well.
Right. That was one thing that was really surprising to me. I expected to see a lot more out of Ronald Powell and Laurenti McRae coming off the edge. I just thought from a standing position in the 3-4 or even just down in the 4-3 that those two would put on a lot better showing. I guess we'll have to see where that goes, because a lot of the pressure that they did get was coming up the middle from guys like Jay Howard and Dominique Easley. One thing that I was thinking about, and I touched on this in a column I wrote with 10 reasons why UAB could potentially pull the upset, was that I think if they can get a couple first downs, these big guys in the middle won't be able to generate as much of a pass rush just because they'll start breathing a little heavier. And it's like just without Sharif Floyd, the rotation's a little bit smaller. I mean, do you see those two potentially getting worn down a little bit?
Well, that's a good point. I guess if the strength of your defensive line is your biggest guys, if a team can put together a sustained drive and do that a couple of times and hold on to the ball, if an offense can hold on to the ball against Florida a decent amount of times, then I think that that would definitely affect the pass rush a lot, because the defensive ends obviously aren't doing a whole lot. FAU had the ball for, 11 minutes in the first half. Like, it was clearly Florida was controlling the ball the whole time in the first half, and then after that, the game was over, basically.
Yeah. And Easley kind of dominated that first half, too, again, because there were so many three and outs. I don't know if he knew this, but it was basically three plays. He had to go as hard as he could go and get in the backfield a couple times and go sit on the bench and rest up a little bit.
So, and he's still cramped up.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they went three and out the first four possessions, mm-hmm. That's not the recipe for success on offense. That's not a good way to wear down a defense. And if you can really establish a rhythm, it'll be interesting to see how Florida responds to that. Another thing that I thought was interesting was just the idea of kind of a letdown. Because I guess this has not historically been the case, but I feel like if you work a whole offseason, you're kind of looking forward to that first game. And then after that, it's kind of you're thinking about maybe SEC play or something like that. And there's that middle game. Historically, they've handled it very well. They blow that team out too. But, I mean, maybe with a young team, do you guys think there's any chance, something like that, where they're not really thinking about UAB and they're looking forward to the start of SEC games?
I think there's definitely a chance of that. The one thing that I think kind of I rule that out because of is, from a coaching standpoint, I would imagine the coaches are trying to find something to motivate the players and to help them play their best and eliminate that possibility. I really think the Sharif Floyd thing might actually be that issue for the team this week, to where they come out really focused and the whole play for Sharif type mentality. I know we saw a couple of players saying things like that on Twitter last night, and I think that really is a thing that can kind of bring a team together like that, when they feel like a guy that is a very important part of this team and a guy who a lot of the players like has been wronged by someone. I feel like that's kind of the way that they view this as coming out and maybe a play for him type mentality.
Yeah, it's good motivation. I don't think there's going to, I mean, it's in play that they could have a fallback, but I feel like they're always going to be motivated when you're playing at home. Like, that is, I mean, it's pretty fun to play in front of 88,000 or 90,000 or whatever it is, whoever it is, and you only get a limited number of games per season in football. I think there's less of a chance of a letdown in football than there's sports like baseball or basketball, where there's a lot of games. You know what I mean? Like, you don't get that many of these, and you spend the whole week kind of preparing for one game.
Right. Those are both fair points. One thing you touched on that I wanted to hit real quick, we don't need to talk about this a lot, but Florida's sellout streak ended last weekend. It was like 137 games, right? Something like that. And then this week, I think there was a lot of return tickets that were unsold from UAB. I haven't heard a whole lot of buzz about it. What do you guys think is going to happen with the kind of a crowd turnout kind of thing? Do you think we could see kind of like the Appalachian State game last year kind of stadium, or do you think it'll pack the house again?
I'd be a little surprised if it was completely sold out, to be honest with you, because here's my reasoning is that the first game of any season should have everybody excited, and the whole fan base is excited for whatever, and then on top of that, you've got a new coach, too, so everybody kind of wanted to see what the offense would look like. Then you've got the start of SEC play with Tennessee next weekend. There's not a whole lot of reason, I think, to be overly excited about this. I mean, obviously people want to see the team play, and there's still a lot of unanswered questions, but the storylines aren't there that there have been, that there was last week and that there will be next week.
Yeah, I agree with Cody. If they're not selling the first game, I don't necessarily see any reason for them to sell the second game. I know Florida Atlantic was given 4,000 tickets and gave back 3,000 of those. Not 30,000 of those. That would have been incredible. They were given 4,000 tickets, gave back 3,000 of those. UAB has given back 3,800 tickets. So
did they get 4,000 too? They sold 200 tickets.
I got to imagine they were given more tickets. I actually don't know the answer to that. But the point is that like it's not like UAB is traveling better than Florida Atlantic for this one. So you're not going to get very much road support here on the sellout front. And if people weren't buying the FAU tickets, why would you be buying these extra UAB tickets? Like, I think the UAB game is going to be a better game, but I also don't see why you would buy the second one, not the first one.
Right, I'm with you on that. So, I mean, I guess that's enough on that. We'll just have to see how that plays out and where it goes from here. Moving over, we talked a little bit about Florida's defense. We talked about Florida's offense. When they go up against UAB, they're facing a new defensive coordinator for UAB. His name is Tommy West. He was not even in football last year. Head coach of Memphis from 2001 until 2009. So apparently, according to Charlie Weiss, that they've been looking at some of what the UAB film from last year to see what their players are capable of on defense. They've been looking a little bit about the Memphis film from 2009 to see what kind of scheme they could be up against. How difficult do you guys think it is for them to have to prepare against kind of two different sets of film? And do you think that could cause them any problems this weekend, or should it be just run-of-the-mill, easy game?
I think there will be maybe some problems initially because you don't really know what they're going to do, but I think pretty quickly on they'll pick up on it. Like I could see like UAB having like two or three really good defensive series against Florida, and then they kind of all huddle up, they talk to what they're seeing in the booth, figure out what's going on, and make the adjustments of like what kind of play calls that need to be made. So I could see an initial issue, but I don't think long, like over the course of the game, I think they'll have it figured out. But yeah, I think there is a little bit of fear on Florida's side of like, we don't necessarily know what we're going into. It's going to be one of two things. It's going to either be what UAB ran last year, or it's going to be what Tommy West did for Memphis last year or 2 years ago. And it's probably going to be more of the latter, so they'll know what to do.
Yeah, it's all about, I think, maybe the thing that could hurt them is having to prepare for so much. But from a scheme standpoint, I think you'd be a little surprised if a defensive coach came in and didn't run the scheme he's been running for 8 years at Memphis.
So, yeah, that's kind of what we were talking about a little bit before with it was something that got brought up a few times in media this week, the idea of having Charlie Weiss and Dan Quinn down there on the sidelines being able to make adjustments in the game and really help them out. That was something that, it's been talked about a little bit in media. Do you guys think that that's as much of a factor as they hype it up to be, where like having that guy there is so much better than having him up in the booth? Is it really that helpful?
I think from a poll standpoint, I guess like I do buy in the fact that like you kind of understand how players are feeling. You can like talk to. It's easier to talk to John Brantley right there when you can just walk to him like during timeouts and stuff. John Brantley doesn't take his helmet off and put a headset on. You just walk right up to him, or between plays, you can kind of talk to him a little bit. But I do think this idea of you get a better vision on the field is completely wrong, and they keep bringing up like players will be like, oh yeah, they can just see things better on the field. But then why isn't everyone doing that? Of course you see things better in the booth. There's a reason that they have the press sitting up higher. There's a reason that there's a booth to begin with, is because you can see the whole field. Like, you can't see the whole field when you're on the field, like contrary to popular belief, or at least what Florida's trying to like say, that like that's not true. The only reason that they're on there is so they can talk to them easier.
Absolutely. Yeah. If anything, I'd say it just breeds more confusion because you're trying to see what's going on. It just gives you more of a headache. You almost can't pay attention to it if you're on the sideline. So I think hearing them kind of talk about it, I'd be a little surprised if this was longer than a one-year deal. I really think it's just a kind of a product of the new offense, because you can hear even Charlie Weiss there today was like, you know, I'm not saying we're going to do this after this year. And he seemed to be very emphatic about that. Muschamp said the same thing. And he was obviously in the booth last year with the Chiefs. So I would imagine it's probably his preference to be up there. I think that's probably where they're going next year. But again, this year, yeah, I think that's all it is just try to be down there to help people out the first year in the offense and then trust some of your veteran players next year.
Yes, it's the typical like Florida, like we're going to feed you something. Like, we're telling you, media guys, this is the best way to do it. It's okay. And then next year it's going to be, that's such a better way to do it. Last year was like, it's always like last year were the mistakes, but at the time there were no mistakes. Right. You know what I mean? It's the same kind of thing.
Right. I think they're definitely putting more of an emphasis on being able to talk to the players on the field and hear what they're seeing from their perspective and then working off that, than having the best view potentially for themselves up top. Because obviously, it's not like they can't see the game from the sidelines. There's going to be little things they miss, but they're going to be able to have their perspective. They're going to be able to have better communication with the players, and maybe that'll help them out better overall. One more thing. Last weekend was obviously a huge weekend for Dempsey and Rainey. Those guys were dominant against FAU. What would you expect to see from them this weekend? You think more of the same? Maybe UAB is going to have a little better defense, slow them down some. Is Florida even going to go to them as often as they did last weekend?
Florida can't. I know Charlie Weiss said like those guys are going to be exhausted at the end of the games, but they can't go to them this frequently each and every game. Jeff Dimps weighs like 180 pounds. Chris Rennie weighs 135 pounds. And I just can't imagine, like, you give them this kind of workload. They touched on, not including incompletions, I had this in a story sometime this week, that I think they touched the ball, those two touched the ball in, like, 55% of plays, if you don't include, like, incompletions. And you just can't keep giving them that kind of workload. Eventually, you've got to get the ball to your other playmakers, or what are being described as playmakers, and let them make more plays. Because, like, honestly, it's just a situation where you can't hold up against SEC defenses. Once you get into that October stretch where you're playing Alabama, you're playing Auburn, you're playing Georgia, you're playing Vanderbilt, you're playing LSU, you don't want any of that.
Especially because you look at last year when they did try to ride Dimps was at Tennessee, and I believe he had 25 or 30 carries, and that's the game that eventually cost him the entire season. He was probable to questionable pretty much the rest of the year. And so I think that's kind of why they have to manage that. Charlie Weiss seems like he's knowledgeable about that. He's brought that up and said that's their responsibility to figure that out. But again, it's going to be interesting. I think this is the way that this will play out this weekend. I think you'll see a lot more of the wide receivers get involved. I think that the way FAU played defense, I know we've heard a lot about that, but dropping sometimes three safeties back, it really kind of eliminated the receivers and opened up that swing pass game a little bit. So I think that's why we'll see maybe some more receivers get involved, assuming UAB doesn't play it like that. And if they do, then be back to the swing pass game.
Right. John Brelli hasn't seen a swing pass that he hasn't liked since he's been at Florida. That's and FAU was just giving those away. Yeah. Like when you leave Chris Rainey and Jeff Dimps wide open in the flats, I mean, I don't blame him for throwing those. Yep. The problem is once you play better defenses and they kind of leave them open a little bit, like maybe not that open, but they'll still leave them open, those 15-yard plays become like 2-3-yard plays, mm-hmm. and those cheers become boos.
Right. There's something to be said for keeping Dimps and Rainey, you know, safe and avoiding injuries and as few touches as possible to still win against FAU and UAB. But let's say it's a game like Tennessee where they know they're going to have to play a close game and they're probably going to be hotly contested back and forth throughout. What number would you set on the amount of touches you'd be willing to have Dempsey and Rainey get in a game like that where it's going to be close and they're going to need them to try to put up as many points as they can to hopefully win the game?
I don't know about numbers, but I would say, like, as opposed to 55%, like 40 to 45%, like, they're still touching the ball more than everyone else, but at least a somewhat responsible number, like, not more than half.
I'm thinking maybe if you gave them combined 30 touches, something like that. I mean, say maybe 15 apiece. Even that might be just a little bit high, especially when you get into some of the bigger the Alabama-type defenses that they'll be facing. But I think there are opportunities to manage it. I mean, you go to that Tennessee game, you can maybe limit some carries against Kentucky, who you would imagine they probably won't be completely necessary for. So there are sometimes you can try to knock that number down just a little bit, but yeah, it's something they're going to have to manage.
Right. I think it's tough because just in the flow of the offense, if they're like on Saturday, they were methodical in the way they moved the ball down the field. It wasn't like they were going big plays. Like if you're going to have a lot of 12, 10, 9 play drives, there's a lot of touches to go around. So, I mean, if they can get some big plays, which is something Muschamp really harps on a lot, if they can create big plays, maybe they don't need to have the guys touch it 30 times a game, but if they're really going to drive down like that, I think they don't have a choice but to get it to their best weapons against some tougher competition. Like, if it's a close game, are they going to purposely avoid them, or are they going to give more carries to Gillislee? Like, what do you think is the way that they avoid that? Because it's not as easy as it might seem to just say, we're not going to give our best players the ball as often as we could.
I think trying to get the receivers more involved would be the big difference. I think what we talked about, obviously, is how many passes in the flats that Brantley had to those two guys. Rainey was the leading receiver with 6 catches. Dimps had like 2 or 3 catches, which is like 9 of Brantley's, what was it, 18, 19, 20 completions. Like that's half of Brantley's completions right there. So getting the ball out to Quentin Dunbar, getting the ball out to Deontay Thompson, Jordan Reed especially. Like I think Jordan Reed could have bigger games. I think that's probably, like we said last week, I think that's going to be being their leading receiver, assuming they go to a traditional passing game as opposed to just dumping it off. So I think just getting the ball to the receivers more would be the best way to avoid overworking Rainey and Dimps.
It's going to be interesting this week, too, because UAB has a veteran secondary. They've got a bunch of linebackers coming back, but it's that defensive line that's really young and inexperienced. So if Florida wanted to run the ball at them, I think this would be a good week to do that. It's just a matter of do you want to have those big carries again for now 2 straight weeks going into Tennessee next weekend.
Well, do you think the answer is ever more carries for a guy like Mike Gillislee or Mac Brown, or is it just to get more pass-heavy if they have to?
I would say it's probably more to be more pass-heavy. I think at this point, if one of those two running backs was capable of getting 10, 15 carries, we probably would have seen it. If, whatever it is, if they're not picking up the playbook or if they're just not protecting the ball well enough in practice, I feel like if they were ready, we would have seen those increased carries by now.
Yeah, I guess it's a mental thing for Mike Gilsley. That would be my assumption. Because, I mean, when he's out there, he always looks pretty good. Like last year, even he's been out in the field kind of in garbage time for the last 2 years, and he's always looked pretty solid. I think he led the team in touchdowns last year also. Like, he can bring a little bit of power. But like you said, I mean, if it's just a thing where he can't get the playbook down or whatever, then I guess it's why you're not seeing much of him.
All right. Well, to wrap up kind of the UAB preview, what's the one thing you guys are going to be looking for on offense? We said on defense it was the secondary. We're going to have to see how they do. I think for me, it's going to be Brantley again, just because last week, obviously, he put up some pretty good numbers, but I don't think he showed a lot. One of the stats we've been throwing around is that he was 0-for-4 on passes of 20-plus yards. When he's trying to go downfield, he was still had struggles with accuracy, maybe didn't have the arm strength he'd like to see on throws like that. So that's one thing. I'm going to be watching Brantley to see what he does this weekend. What are you guys looking for?
Yeah, it's definitely the deep passing game. Just for the sake of being different, I'll say Quentin Dunbar. We've heard so much about him since spring. And he didn't have a great game. He had an okay game. And that's not all to his fault. He just didn't get the ball that much. And if he's the deep threat that he's supposed to be, I'd like to see him running some fly routes. You get the ball out to him. I think they threw one fly route to him at the beginning of the second half or something like that. Or maybe it was in one of the earlier drives in the beginning of the game, actually. But it ended up being, like, underthrown or something like that. And I'd like to see them testing the waters with him deep more.
I'm going to take the other receivers, the Deontay Thompsons, the Frankie Hammond, Andre DeBose. I think they need some of those guys to step up a little bit and just at least make the opponent respect them, especially going into SEC play. You can't lock down on one receiver in Dunbar and maybe a Jordan Reed type guy. They've got to have some guys that they can go to, and I think this is the game that they really need to establish that before they start conference play.
Yeah, apparently Andre DeBose is the master of the one-step hitch route or whatever, the quick hit route, so maybe we can see more of that. It's like they ran how many, three times, four times?
I think so.
It's the most elementary play ever, and like, let's just keep doing it because apparently they're just leaving them room. I don't know.
Yeah,
they still messed that up somehow.
That's true. One got tipped, I believe. But yeah, he's kind of a guy I think that would fit that, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, if you're giving him 10 yards, if you're just giving him a 10-yard bump, I have no problem just throwing the ball at the line, seeing what he can do.
Right. We talked about this on Monday a little bit. There's nothing that I had that could possibly explain why FAU decided to defend Florida the way they did. Like, when you look at if you watch any game from last year, you know what John Brantley and what Florida loves to do is to dump it offshore and just get the ball to the playmakers and let them do what they can. So your response to that is to leave open every short pass and just let them have whatever they want every play. I don't think we'll see the same thing from UAB.
If there's one thing we saw in film from Florida last year, it's that they can't throw the ball downfield. And so FAU says, whatever we're going to do, we're not going to let them throw the ball downfield. We'll let them get the easy stuff. Don't let them beat you deep.
All right, now it's about time to wrap up the show with our Gator guarantees. Before we get into this week's, we'll wrap up last week's. We'll start. Mine was that Sharif Floyd, Dominique Easley, or Ronald Powell would say something crazy after they all had a great game. Then we got kind of derailed by a few different things. First of all, as we've already discussed, Sharif Floyd didn't get to play, so that's a bummer. Now it's down one already. Ronald Powell was not available to the media after the game and through this week, and the same thing with Dominique Easley. So, I mean, I'll take a loss. I kind of want to count it as like a push, but I guess I have to take a loss.
Yeah, that's a loss on that one. A lot of people requested Dominique Easley to talk after the game. My theory is that he was just so busy cramping up because he was just dancing in the locker room the whole time. Was there a more fun player to watch during the game than Dominique Easley?
No, definitely.
Specifically on the sidelines. Cody pointed this out, and I watched it later on ESPN because I watched a replay. But there's one segment where they're just showing the Gators defensive line on the bench, and they're just sitting there, and then some song starts playing, and Dominique Easley gets up and starts dancing. And it's not some abrasive defensive lineman dance. It's a very subtle, a lot of fluid hips, a lot of shifting, a lot of footwork. It's a very, very delicate dance that he's doing. And then Dan Quinn just shows up and pushes him back on the bench.
For sure. And on the field, it was a lot of fun to watch, too. I didn't see this, but Tyler told me he put a guy in the torture rack, which is an interesting move.
Yes.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, the running back, Morris, for FAU, was going to pass block. And for whatever reason, Dominique Easley picked him up and held him on his shoulders for a second. If anyone watched the WCW back in the 1990s, that's what Lex Luger used to do to people when he was finishing people off. Not Lex Luger, the bad guy from Superman, but the professional wrestler.
So yeah, Dominique Easley, a lot of fun to watch on game day. So.
Yeah, spotlight him. And during warmups, spotlight Quentin Dunbar, because that guy's a lot of fun to watch during warmups. He dances around a lot, too.
There's a lot of dancers on the team, for sure. All right, last week, Tyler's guarantee was that FAU would leave the visitors' locker room spotless because they had two Eagle Scouts on the squad. Tyler, you want to report back on how that turned out?
I was a little disappointed. For the most part, it was pretty clean, but there was a table in the middle of the place with a holder where you could put Gatorade bottles. And I know that wasn't FAU stuff. I get that that's the Gator stuff. But those guys know better. They're Eagle Scouts. Leave no trace behind. And there was a trace. So I was a little bit disappointed in you guys, all right?
Maybe they'll get them next time. I'm sure they'll be back.
They'll be clean next week.
And then Cody's guarantee was that Demps and Rainey would combine for 220 rushing yards, which I guess looking back on it is just an absolutely ridiculous claim because they played about as well as I could have imagined them playing and still came up a little short. I think we just looked it up as 184 combined. Cody, what was your reaction to this? Did you think you had it partway through the game? You thought we were going to pull that one out?
I thought there was a chance, but then looking at the score, I figured there was probably no way. I needed maybe one long one to break that didn't happen. Probably should have said combined yardage, but
Yeah, I'll take it. You would have had it for sure.
I'll take my loss.
Yeah, definitely the fact they didn't get a really long run definitely held them back. Because, like, last year, those first couple games, Jeff Demps was just busting off, like, 70-yard runs, like, 65-yard runs. Like, he was just breaking them off big time. And this time, it was a lot of, like, 10, 15-yard runs.
Didn't pull through for me.
Yeah, too many flash passes. Anyway, moving into this week's, Tyler, we'll start with you. What do you got for us?
John Brantley is going to be going downfield because he's been hearing it from us. He's been hearing it from everyone. Time to chuck the ball deep, and he will throw two interceptions.
Wow.
Right. He tried to go deep with Deontay Thompson, threw to triple coverage. He tried to go deep with Gerald Christian and completely overthrew him. He went short on Quentin Dunbar. So the times we saw him go deep were not good.
How many deep passes do you think we're going to see, like 20-plus yards downfield? Give me a number.
I'm going to say seven.
Because last week he didn't even have to go downfield to throw 2-plus interceptions. That was easy for him.
Well, one was tipped. That wasn't fair to him. But the one of his four that were downfield was an underthrown interception to triple coverage, which someone later tried to defend as, like, that was Charlie Weiss's fault. I don't remember. Do you remember that, Cody? We heard someone talking about that.
I don't think I do, actually.
That can't be accurate. There's no way.
Someone said that afterward, and I wanted to rip into that person.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Cody, what do you got for us this week? What's your guarantee?
I'm going to go with Jordan Reed makes his impact on the offense. I'm going to say 100 yards? Yeah, we'll say 100 yards and two touchdowns.
More lofty yardage totals from Cody Jones. I like it.
He's not afraid
to make bold predictions.
When I get one right, you're going to hear about it.
For sure. And if that happens, I'm going to piggyback on one of Greg's guarantees from last week, and that Jordan Reed will give a very boring interview afterward.
No, that's not likely. Bold. That's not bold at all.
Most likely, yeah. I like that prediction. I think we all expected to see a little bit more of Jordan Reed than we saw last week. So now he's kind of a little bit of a post-type sleeper pick for Cody Jones here. I like it.
Absolutely.
Mine for this week is that UAB quarterback Brian Ellis throws for 300 yards. I don't necessarily trust the Gators secondary. We talked about how they're unproven, so I can see him and the spread offense having a big day. I don't think UAB pulls off the upset. This was something I flirted with a little bit. I think it'll be a closer game than people expect, but 300 yards for Ellis is what I'm going with.
Okay, I guess that's going to kind of wrap it up. We've got to, I guess, share our Twitter handles before we leave.
Tyler, start us off. Tyler, _Jet, right?
That's TYLER_Jet. Also, friend me on Facebook if you want. I'm lonely on Facebook.
Yeah, we should call that out more often. I could use some more Facebook friends. Just look for Brandon Marshall. It's Greg Luca.
And
my Twitter is @GregLucas, so you can find me there. Cody, what's your stuff? And you can talk about Fighting Gators a little bit for us.
All right, yeah, my Twitter handle is CJonesFIGators because I work for Fighting Gators. It sounds kind of weird. I should probably change it. But, Fighting Gators, we're part of the Scout.com network and just cover the team, football, basketball, baseball, and all sorts of information, message boards, all the things that
the
fans like. Lots of recruiting. That's kind of the main staple of it. Not by me, but by people a lot smarter than me. So that's very beneficial for people as well.
Solid. If you're going to change your Twitter handle, make sure you don't do it anytime soon because you got that big podcast bump coming.
Here comes that follower.
Give it at least 7 days.
There you go. All right. So that about wraps up the show for us. Make sure you check us out on iTunes. Subscribe there. Go on Facebook.com/AlligatorPodcast. That's where you can... we'll be updating that page. We send all the latest podcasts out there, too. Be sure to comment or like any of those things. And then another way to give us feedback is to send emails to podcast@alligator.org. We're always checking those. We're always keeping an eye out. So hit us up there if you have any suggestions, maybe guests you want us to bring in. We didn't get anything too big about Cody. Nobody hated him. Nobody loved him, I guess.
It's disappointing. I'm just average.
We decided to bring him back in anyway because we thought he did a pretty good job. So
we like you, Cody.
Yeah, if you have any favorite guests, we'll try to get them on and any suggestions about things you want us to talk about, maybe some smaller sports you'd like to have us throw in here. We have a couple extra minutes, so just let us know what you guys think. And until then, thanks for listening.